You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Milton.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Couldn't be better. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Milton Lawson, and this is one of the more unusual podcasts I've done, I got to say, and it has one of the more elaborate backstories. Let me say, for starters, that you are an author of comic book / graphic novels. I gather from you, actually, that the distinction between the two is not as clear as some might think. Right. Among your past works, I was browsing around your website, which is what, MiltonLawson.com?
Yeah.
Is that right? And I saw, that's L-A-W-S-O-N, I saw one of your works, Thompson Heller, Detective Interstellar. There was a link to the Simon & Schuster website where I could find out more, and it said, Thompson Heller, Detective Interstellar is a space noir about a private detective roaming the galaxy solving cases steeped in moral intrigue. Now, as cosmic as that may sound, I think this thing we're going to mainly talk about today, called Orson Welles' Warrior of the Worlds, is in some sense probably weirder than Thompson Heller. We'll get to that. It's based on a real person, Orson Welles, who of course did this famous broadcast, War of the Worlds, which we'll talk about. But the story itself is not just fictional, but out there. Yeah. I don't know. Is it fantasy? Is it science fiction? What is this genre, Milton?
I would call it science fiction, maybe science fiction / alternate history.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely. This is not the real history that is in this book. So now, backstory. So you used to work for me, these many years ago, I think starting in 2007 or something, for Blogging Heads TV, which was the kind of predecessor of the Non-Zero podcast. We were doing split screen video before many people, I would say. In fact, we were doing it since 2005, Blogging Heads was. So you joined us pretty early on, worked for us for a time. But your true passion, I gather, was this kind of world of comic books, graphic novels. You went on to do stuff in that realm. Now, a few months ago, you emailed me and suggested something intriguing, which was that you would come on the podcast and interview me, and then maybe you humbly suggested there would be time at the end to talk a little about your latest work. I suggested we flip the script.
That's a much better
first,
way.
I thought you would prefer it.
Yeah, the things I'm going to interview you on is, I'm very much out of my depth, admittedly, but I want to take the privilege to ask you some questions, having been a, you know, employee and a fan for decades here. So I'm looking forward to that part.
Yeah,
well.
I'm actually mildly apprehensive about this. I have no idea what you've got lined up for me. But anyway, so for starters, before we get into, I want to talk a little about Orson Welles' fascinating character, and then talk about what you do with his story, the story you convert him into. But first, I want to ask a little about this subculture that you're the kind of guy who would go to Comic-Con, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the thing to my side right here is one of my visual aids that I take with me to the conventions. I've got a little sign for people who are not familiar with the War of the Worlds story.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain why I did not wind up in this subculture? I mean, what kinds of people do wind up in it? I mean, I don't think I had much of a chance. I didn't even read comic books. I think when I was like 9 years old, I read Archie Comics for about 3 months. That was it. I didn't really watch cartoons on TV. My parents were actually worried. They asked me why the other kids watched cartoons on TV and I didn't. So I just don't think I was a candidate for this. What kinds of people are? What is it in you? When did you get into this stuff?
Well, I was into this stuff from a very early age. I have to say, there's quite a stark difference in subculture generationally. When I first got into this type of material, and I went to my first comic convention in the 1980s, mm-hmm. and the demographics there would have been 99% white male. Mm. And like the one girl that would be at the convention would just be swarmed with all of these mm-hmm. geeks salivating over her.
Were you one of them? I mean, be honest. Were you one of them?
No, I was too shy. I was kind of mm-hmm. on the fringe looking at the people who were
okay.
and admiring them and trying to gain strategies good. There.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay.
But, yeah. So, and then, contrast that to today. Today, during the warmer months of a given year, throughout the country, there will be multiple conventions taking place. Millennials and Gen Z folks, they have taken the concept of going to these conventions as just like an outing, just like something to do. It is not necessarily a statement of your personal expression, although that is certainly part of it for some people. A lot of people go to just people watch. Families will come with the multi-stroller thing, and people will walk around in costume.
So are they not all like readers of the genres? Or they? In other words, they're there almost as anthropologists, some of them?
Yeah, but more of them will be into something film or television related. Mm-hmm, a lot mm-hmm. of the comic conventions, call the name Comic-Con, has sort of been adopted by what is really a pop culture convention. And the actual comics portion will be segregated off into smaller and smaller containers.
But now, it's like a subset of TV that would, like Xena, Warrior Princess, or whatever, there would be that.
Right.
There would not be like, you know, White Lotus.
But you would be surprised. But like one show that happened in Houston several years ago, the primary draw was the majority of the cast of the Sons of Anarchy show, which is a show about a bunch of biker gangs. Mm. And so there were hundreds, if not thousands, of folks in leather jackets and jean jackets and tattoos. And the promoter of that show was actually fraudulent. And a lot of the people left.
Allegedly fraudulent. We should
allegedly. So sorry. Sorry. Up, allegedly,
you know,
fraudulent.
Somebody money. Yeah.
They're out of business now. So, but anyway, were hundreds of very angry biker fans who had paid hundreds of dollars to like, for example, one thing you get at these shows is like autograph and photograph opportunities. Mm-hmm. And you can pay sometimes a ridiculous amount to get an autograph or a photograph. And I, you know, even though I'm there to conduct business, a lot of times I find myself drawn to that lure as well. And I've had a few, you know, photographs taken.
Whose autograph
folks.
Have you paid for, Milton?
I didn't pay for an autograph, but I paid for a picture with Mike Tyson. And one Ooh. Thing that was hilarious.
What, you and Mike in the same frame?
Me and Mike in the same frame. Oh,
I'd pay for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing is there was like a little makeshift curtain where he would wait before he came out to do the photo ops and everything. And all the other stars at the show were so starstruck by Mike Tyson, they would come to visit him. So like the entire cast of Star Trek The Next Generation were at Mike Tyson's booth getting pictures with Mike Tyson, you know.
I got to say, that makes sense to me. That reflects my own conception of the relative significance of these people. Mike Tyson will be remembered long after that cast,
right?
Of which I could not name a single member, has been forgotten. Now, Orson Welles. Okay, so you're... okay, but you also read comics. First, a little more on the subculture. Yeah. So you read, like, comics. So what kind of comics did you read? Was it sci-fi and fantasy early on, or...?
Early, it was pretty much just, you know, straight superhero stuff. Marvel and DC. You know, that's my baptism into that was in the late 70s. Goodness, I'm old. And then in the 90s is when we sort of had a sort of British invasion of talent, sort of like the British invasion of rock music in the 60s. In the 90s, a lot of British writers kind of came over and revolutionized American comics. So there were a lot of inventive non-superhero stories, most famous of which is the Sandman series. And I was a huge follower of that. And there was a publisher called Vertigo Comics that was owned by DC, but they did more cutting edge adult material. And so I got into that stuff in the 90s. And then in the 2000s is when I started getting the itch to, you know, actually do it myself.
But you didn't read Archie Comics ever.
Sure. I did read Archie a little bit. You know, back in the good old days where, you know, you'd go to a mall and there'd be a B. Dalton or a Walden Books, and they would have the little digests of Archie and Family Circus.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The collected works.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny. Like, these days, I mean, superheroes have entered mainstream culture. I mean, they've been with us for a long time. I used to watch, I did watch the series Superman as a kid, the actual, you know, the one starring George Reeves. And it had been, I think, filmed in the 50s, and these were reruns. So superheroes and, you know, those comics were around since, I guess, the 30s or 40s or something. But then they entered culture in a new way, it seems to me, at some point over the last, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. They started becoming Hollywood blockbusters. And, you know, these days, journalists who are like 20 years younger than me are likely to be conversant in their, like, superhero mythology in a way that I never was and that my peers never were, right?
Right, right.
So that's a part thing.
And part of what's, for those of us that were on the train all along, it's been fascinating to see that evolution happen. And, you know, there were a lot of aborted attempts to try to adapt specifically Marvel characters in television and film throughout the years. And they would always do these really severe compromises that may have been due to either, you know, a technological constraint or just an aesthetic view of the material that would always disappoint the fans. And then finally, Marvel took full ownership of their properties from a multimedia point of view, and they started making them, and just they just went all out, completely faithful to the original source material. And now, like you say, some of these journalists who never actually read the books are conversant in concepts like, you know, the Infinity Gauntlet, which was a very obscure, you know, trivia point, you know, 20 years ago, but is now a widely known piece of American culture.
Not so widely that it's reached me, but yeah, I take your point. So, okay. So Orson Welles, first of all, let me say that your graphic novel, I mean, I just got access to it a couple of days ago, and I can say that it's genuinely engrossing. Orson Welles, Warrior of the Worlds. So people can order it now. You think it'll be available in May? And where do they go to order it?
We're publishing it via a method that is pretty popular in the comics industry right now, through crowdfunding on Kickstarter. And just the easiest way to get to the Kickstarter is to go orsonwellscomic.com. And you can pre-order the book. I've already sent the files to my printer, and so we're hoping that the actual books will arrive in about 6 to 8 weeks. So,
and this is a physical book people can order, an actual physical book.
Yes,
I've seen the digital version, but it's now who did the illustration? Eric Whalen. Is that the illustrator?
Eric Whalen.
Very handsome. It looks like the real thing, you know?
Yeah. He's a very talented guy. I'm very lucky to have gotten to work with him on this.
So Orson Welles, let's talk about the guy himself for a second. Fascinating, a prodigy, I guess a kind of enfant terrible. If there's anybody out there who's, for whatever reason, maybe due to youth or something, not at all conversant in this guy, you know, first of all, he was a famous director. Some people, his first movie, Citizen Kane, which I think came out when he was still in his 20s, has been hailed by a number of people as like the greatest movie ever or the greatest movie as of that era or something. And he's done a number of other movies. I think some people would say he wasn't as productive as he might have been had he been somewhat less hedonistic or whatever. I don't know how they would put it, but he enjoyed life. I don't know. He did have at least a dozen movies, many of them fairly well known. Anyway, but the thing that you that provides the kind of premise for your book is something he did at age 23, and he's perhaps most famous for, is this radio dramatization of War of the Worlds, which was a novel written by H.G. Wells, no relation, I assume, so far as we know, who's British. And, you know, it's funny when this drone, remember the spate of drone sightings in New Jersey happened a few months ago?
Yeah.
I almost tweeted a joke about Grover's Mill, but I figured nobody would get it. I
would have treasured that joke.
I live not far from Grover's Mill. I've been to Grover's Mill. In the radio broadcast, that is the site of the first reports of, you know, the Martian landings. Anyway, so what he did, of course, is this was part of the Mercury Radio Theater, which I think itself was a spinoff of a Mercury Theater he had founded along with John Houseman. In any event, you know, he did it as a live, as if it were a news report. Now, they did say at the very beginning, what follows is fiction or something, but supposedly enough people tuned in late and took it seriously that some people actually freaked out. I don't know if that's been exaggerated or what. I think it probably fell short of a true national panic. Have you? What is your take on the extent of it?
It's a fascinating thing. I believe what happened is we've had a series of overcorrections in the narrative about the panic. I think there was a fairly popular piece. It might have been in Slate or Salon, early 2000s, late 90s, that raised the argument that the narrative of the panic was not a real thing, that it was ginned up by the newspaper industry because they felt that they were under threat by radio. So this was a convenient way for them to attack a competing medium, and that was the real source of it. But just recently, a couple of months ago, a new book came out on this topic that I found fairly persuasive, that has gone through a series of archives that are housed in some library somewhere that collects and collates a lot of the primary field reports from police stations, from operators, switchboards, and those sorts of things. And there were quite a number of people that were genuinely terrified and took rather extreme measures. People fled their homes. People let their animals loose. One famous incident, which may or may not be true, but the folks in it, in the contemporary reporting, were seemingly completely candid about it. They mistook a water tower for an alien tripod and shot at the water tower. So there were rumors of suicides. I don't know if there's any concrete proof of any of that per se. But my feeling is that there was certainly something there. And I don't know if you have any anecdotal like family memories, like, but from my family, my grandmother, you know, she was listening at the time in Mississippi, and she was terrified. She thought it was real.
Yeah, huh. No, I don't recall anything. I mean, my parents lived out in, let's see. By that time, yeah, my mother was still on a farm in West Texas. I don't think they had a radio. But anyway, do you think it was calculated? Like, I saw, I've seen a film of the press conference he gave the next day apologizing. Mm-hmm. And I got the sense that it was almost, he was almost winking. As he said, I, of course, had no idea that this would happen. It was almost with a nod and a wink, like that it was, it couldn't help but be the case that some people would be taken in, right? Because Although they make the announcement at the beginning about it being fiction, you know, people are like cruising along the radio dial. Somebody in the country is bound to just come along. And it sounded like an authentic news broadcast for a good part of time.
Yeah. And the disclaimer was given sort of in the fashion that we have now with our, you know, pharmaceutical ads with the side effects.
Oh,
you know, so you kind of, it's just kind of droney, like it wouldn't have registered with everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So do you think it was calculated? He was hoping it would create a controversy?
Oh, yeah. In fact, his performance in that press conference, I ranked that as one of his top five acting performances of his career. And that was pure acting on his point.
Yeah. Now, here's where it gets weird, is where your story, and you know, I was engrossed. I had to exercise self-discipline to not get deeper into the thing. It's a true novel. It's a true graphic novel.
Yeah.
And until I finish my own book, I can't do anything for more than about 20 minutes without starting to feel guilty. So after about half an hour, I peeled myself away. But it's truly engrossing. And it's funny, the elements. Well, first of all, tell us, like, what's the basic premise of the story?
The basic premise of the story is that the story that we've been told throughout all of our lives, that this radio broadcast of War of the Worlds was a radio dramatization, was in fact a lie. It really was a true event that was broadcast live on the radio. And what happens after that is a cover-up, and Orson Welles leads a secret double life, joining a government agency, protecting Earth from aliens. Mm-hmm. And so my catchphrase slogan for it is, he shoots movies during the day, shoots aliens at night.
Okay. Now, I should interject just in case somebody joined us only 30 seconds ago. This is not an actual conspiracy theory on your part. You wrote a fictional graphic novel in which this is the story. And you work in all these biographical elements. I didn't even know that he and the director, Peter Bogdanovich, were kind of friends. But it turns out, once I saw Bogdanovich show up early in your book, it turns out that they actually co-authored they had some conversations that they published. But anyway, you draw a lot on his actual life, right? You bring these people in as characters.
Yes, yes. Some of which are completely authentic and true, such as Bogdanovich. Some are sort of like composite characters, and some are like really deep cuts. That's where we go with it.
How did you have this idea?
You know what? I usually remember the kernel of every major project I've ever done. And this one, I honestly cannot remember the genesis. I think it was inevitable, though, because just I've been a science fiction fan my whole life. And in 1991, I was getting much more serious in my cinephilia. Reaching out to more than just what was contemporary, and went to a screening of Citizen Kane for its 50th anniversary. And I saw it for the first time in a movie theater in 35 millimeter. And I was so blown away by it. I was completely and utterly transformed. It changed my life. I walked out of that theater a different person. And I immediately just started researching everything I could about Wells. And I got fascinated. And at that point in time, one of the fascinating things about Wells was, even though he had been dead for about 6 years at that point, he still had several, you know, films to come out, because when he died, a lot of his projects were unfinished, or some of the versions that came out were like compromised versions. And so there were restorations and completions. One of his films was actually kind of held hostage in Iran for decades. I mean, this is just the level.
They had
the
physical copy of the film in Iran for some reason.
Yeah. One of the financiers was an Iranian person, and just, you know, people passed away and business organizations dissolved and everything. And then it became like, well, this estate versus that estate versus that estate and the government of Iran and all that. And so I was chasing and investigating someone who was dead, but still had things to offer in the future.
For some reason, this reminded me, this is just an interjection. Did you happen to see this documentary about this guy who wanted to make the movie Dune and never made it?
Jodorowsky's Dune. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So amazing. I mean, he created, in effect, a graphic novel in the course of just planning the movie out, right?
But
the movie is, anyway, amazing story.
And Wells was going to be in that too, by the way.
He was
one of the cast members.
Yeah, the whole premise. Oh, and also Salvador Dali was going to be in it.
Salvador Dali, Mick Jagger. Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, this guy would approach, like, he definitely understood that there are certain ways you can make a splash. And one is to have Salvador Dali, Mick Jagger, and Orson Welles in your movie, I guess. Anyway, that version was never made. And when he saw the David Lynch movie, he said he was delighted by how bad it was, which I think many people would say, notwithstanding David Lynch's many great works. So anyway, I got us off track. So what blew you away about Citizen Kane, for starters?
Well, for one thing, I had a bias, like a lot of people do when they're younger, that you have this sort of sense that everything that happened in the past was just so archaic and fuddy-duddy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, black and white in particular had no appeal to me. And
how old were you when you saw it, roughly?
I was early 20s.
Okay.
And I found myself kind of like grabbed by the lapel by this creative force. And I was taken on this journey, and I was aware at all times that there was a singular vision driving this experience. And it was the most authorial, you know, film I had ever seen at that point. You know, film is an inherently collaborative medium, but here is a person who announces themselves in every frame. And, you know, some critics of Wells will say, he's a bit of a show off. But
so he starred in it and wrote it and directed it.
Yes. The family of Herman Mankiewicz would want me to say that he co-wrote it. that's another controversy there, but yeah. Yeah.
And it's known for, there's certain, I guess, firsts, like the extreme close-up on a face, right? Like I guess it's maybe the first movie where you see such close-ups, and then later that becomes a, you look skeptical, like I've got the story wrong.
Well, you're there that it's something related to focus, but you could either call it deep focus or pan focus, which is... He would actually photograph it in such a way to where everything was in focus, foreground, midground, and background. And so the environments that he, it just occurred to me why I'm obsessed with one part of comics. But, you know, and he would show ceilings. he would do low camera angles, and you know, people never saw ceilings before. So, but yeah, the pan focus or deep focus was considered an innovation. One of the critiques of the praise of Citizen Kane is that if you isolate every single technique that it is lauded for, you can find a precedent for it before it happened in Kane. But mm-hmm. this was the first time someone just brought a symphony of the entirety mm-hmm. of film capabilities into one two-hour film.
Yeah. Now, what I was alluding to is just the very tight framing of the face. Like, the face is the whole screen.
Yeah, he would
do
that.
Shots like that, right? And then,
yeah, for sure.
And then that, it's funny, in the 50s, that becomes kind of a signature of the Twilight Zone. I don't know if you can tell a Twilight Zone if you're just flipping through the channels, you can spot a Twilight Zone and kind of via kind of the visual texture. And that's one thing you get a lot in Twilight Zones. But anyway, so you fall in love with him or his work, and then you're not sure how exactly the idea for this arose.
It was inevitable though, because you know there are a lot of you know, the cliche example of this is like Abraham Lincoln vampire hunter. There are a lot of comics that's
a real thing. That's an actual title.
That's an act, and it's actually a very successful book series. There are a number of books that take that sort of formula. And so I must have applied that formula at some point. Two of my favorite genres, Orson Welles and science fiction, they just collided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to know what the orb is, man. But we don't want any plot spoilers. And let's just say an orb shows up early, very early.
Yes, page 1.
And right away, it's one of the things that's drawing you along.
Yes.
No, you do a good job of making it enthralling from the beginning. There's several other trails I definitely want to follow. How long is the thing?
240 pages.
Whoa. And that's, do you happen to have an account of the number of illustrations?
I think you subtract like 10 or 15 from that number. So yeah. Oh, you mean like individual panels?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see, some quick math. I usually average about 5 panels per page. So that's 500, 1,000.
I'm guessing about 1,000 then, based on my.
Yeah. Yeah.
Impressive. So this is a lot of work. And I mean, a lot of words, a lot of work on the part of your illustrator, too.
Yes.
So how much can you not say much more without, like, I don't want to spoil the plot. I mean, I do. I'd like to know what the order turns out to be. But I don't want you to spoil your potential audience. What can you say?
Yeah, I could give a little bit more of an expectation. There are 7 chapters, and every chapter is a very distinct, separate story, but it all connects into one larger narrative. Each one of the chapters is either directly inspired by or somewhat aesthetically similar to an Orson Welles film, with the exception
you mean,
of
a different film for each chapter.
Yeah, a different film for each chapter.
Whoa!
There's one chapter that's really not true of, but several of them. There's at least you will be able to find one key touch point. I mean, like, just to give an obvious one, towards the middle of the story, there's no way you can do a Orson Welles inspired story without, referencing The Third Man. So there's an entire chapter that's very much an homage to The Third Man. And the spine of the entire narrative is somewhat similar to Citizen Kane. Just like in Citizen Kane, our title character dies in the opening scene and mutters some somewhat mysterious words. And this, another character
Rosebud? In Citizen Kane, it's Rosebud, right?
Yes, in Citizen Kane, it's Rosebud. And
we won't get into some of the theories about what that's a reference to, Milton.
Oh, yes. But the people who do know.
Family show.
Yes. That could have been, you know, earlier in the conversation, we were talking about, you know, one of the tragedies of Wells is that a lot of people will say that he did not live up to his potential. And some will argue the hedonism angle. I do think that that is somewhat overblown. One of the more particularly supposedly hedonistic things he had that the studio got really mad at was when he was doing part of a goodwill tour to help the war effort in Brazil. FDR and Rockefeller sent him to Brazil to sort of a cultural outreach. And the way that the Hollywood executives tell the story is that Wells was just there drinking it up and whoring it up and, you know, wasting the studio's money. But one of the preeminent Orson Welles scholars actually got a hold of all of the accounting and actually proved that Wells was actually under budget for the entire effort. And what really sank him was the audaciousness of taking on Hearst at such an early age.
Oh, did Hearst retaliate and try to sabotage his career?
Not only did he retaliate, you know, he put pressure on the entire Hollywood system, and the heads of all the different studios convened and considered paying RKO, which was the studio that made Citizen Kane, paying them the total budget of Citizen Kane to destroy the film.
Whoa.
Yeah. And then after that, even he managed to survive that, but his next film was completely destroyed by the studio, and it was part of the aftermath of the war against Hearst.
You mean it never came out, the next film? Or I thought next film was The Magnificent Ambersons, but maybe I'm...
It did come out, but it was severely butchered. It was almost cut in half. And there's actually the kind of like the holy grail of cinema is people are still trying to find the original version. And he had the full version with him in Brazil. And there's a documentary filmmaker right now in Brazil trying to track it down.
But this is a common problem for directors, right? Like they don't get the director's cut. The studio's always doing this. Do we really know that this was some kind of act of that Hearst was behind this or something? Or
Well, no. This specific thing was the RKO studio. The person that took over the studio after the guy that was in charge during Citizen Kane, basically one of the, you know, signature moves that he wanted to do to say, hey, the adults are in charge now. You know, they literally put on their letterhead, showmanship, not genius, which was a dig at Wells. And, but you are right that sort of thing happens a lot in Hollywood. But the reason why we get director's cuts eventually is the original material is still somewhere in some vault somewhere. Whereas these people were very malicious and actively destroyed the film sort of out of spite.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what may have been a bridge too far is really the word Rosebud. The origin story I've heard is true, he was just begging Hearst to retaliate.
Yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
And he seems like he was that kind of guy. He just wanted to be in your face.
Yeah.
So, So did I, is there more you want to say about your story? I don't want to push you too far.
I would just say it runs the entirety of his entire career from the moment of the War of the Worlds broadcast up until his death. And we've got this elaborate science fiction story that takes place in the mm-hmm. background. But one of the structural constraints I put on myself was I made sure not to violate anything that we do know about his actual life. Mm-hmm. So the sort of conceit behind this is like everything you're seeing in my story happened, but also everything that you know about Wells also happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So it starts at the moment of his death. That's where the narrative starts. And so then you have a detective story right away. Because yeah. these people who kind of knew him try to figure out exactly what's going on. They see like signs of weird stuff right away and try to track it down. So you're drawn into the mystery right away of what his secret life was.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of famous and infamous side characters that we meet along the way, some of which you've already referenced, and there are a few others that come into play.
These are real people?
Real people. And some of them were inspired by real people, and some of them might sue me. So, hey, let's see how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. that would be in the true spirit of Orson Welles.
Indeed.
Okay. So I guess we're about to move into the part of the conversation that you had suggested should be first, which is you interviewing me, which is an all too rare phenomenon. I got to say, I think I'm under interviewed, but, before we do that, tell people again where they can order this thing. Again, technically a Kickstarter, but it's not one of those things where that means you may not get it in the end, because I've seen.
Right. That. Yeah, there's a little bit of a problem with Kickstarter where people use the platform to bankroll a project from its origin, whereas here we're just doing it to do it at the very end to handle some of the printing costs. So the book is entirely completed and it's ready to go. And you can find it at orsonwellscomic.com. And mm-hmm. you can just follow my ongoing ramblings and stuff at my Substack, which is milton.substack.com. I was an early adopter in Substack, so I got mm-hmm. I got a nice URL there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to say as vaguely as possible that you and I talked beforehand about something that it looks like may well come out of this that I wish we could talk about because it's very exciting, but we can't.
So. Yeah. What I can say is that there is a multimedia adaptation effort in the works, and it's something that I'm very, very excited about. You know, with these sorts of things, just because something's in the works doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see it in that other medium at some point in the future. But I've been really fortunate and just overwhelmed. You know, when you try to create something, you're hoping it can connect. And a handful of the people that have seen it are just over the moon with it. And so I've got a boost of confidence.
Truly, really, I got to say, I'm impressed. I mean,
oh, thank you.
I couldn't
thank
do
you.
This. And I'm not surprised that there's interest from, I can't describe it in any more detail, but people yeah. would be impressed if I described in more detail where the interest is coming, where some of the interest is coming from. Okay. So, now we're going to go into overtime. You didn't think you were going to interview me in public, did you, Milton? Overtime
no
is
way.
Available to all paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. You can get there and become a paid subscriber by clicking the link in the show notes of the audio podcast. I think there's a link in the YouTube version. Oh, by the way, don't be shy about smashing the like button or rating or reviewing us. We encourage people to do this, become Non-Zero members. Then you always get the overtime. It's just like part of your podcast feed. Believe me, folks, you won't regret it. Right, Milton?
I only regret about 5% of the non-zero content, and that's the content where Mickey Kaus
says
the phrase Trumpism without Trump, but we can get to that in the locker room there.
All right. Thanks everybody for following us this far. Hope you'll follow us into the locker room.